I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, Ralph, how are you, bud?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. I was just, I would say enjoying, but I was certainly under the spell of the elevator music there. So if you tapped in and heard me doing weird Tom Waits impersonations or anything to pass the time.
I missed it. You didn't record it? I missed it.
I recorded the whole thing. I can send you the clip, but I was like, this music just makes me want to do my best sort of Tom Waits as a weather forecast announcer. Like, well, the weather in Cincinnati today is cloudy with a high chance of rain. Ralph, congratulations, my friend. I'm talking to you on release day.
Thank you.
I know what those days are like. I've spent lockdown writing a book, so my release day for that is imminent. It's not here yet, but I can only imagine the feeling of elation and release and accomplishment and all of those things together. Before we get into the film, obviously, you know, you've been involved in the Tony Hawk video game franchise since day dot, really. You were there from, you know, the very birth of the franchise. You saw it grow from the ground level up. So I wonder if we could backtrack first to around 99 or perhaps even a little bit before that, and talk about your involvement in this game, the first one, how it all came about to begin with from your side of things.
Yeah, well, I mean, I just sort of lucked into it. When I was going to school, when I was going to college, like being a video game producer wasn't a thing. It wasn't a career path there. At that time, video games were developed by a single programmer and maybe a couple of programmers. And so you really didn't need a production staff or person at all. So, but I've always been a huge fan of video games. I spent plenty of quarters in the arcades playing all the different arcade games, and then had a PC through college and played tons of PC games. And, you know, I've always been a big fan. And through a friend, I happen to know the owner of Neversoft. And, you know, we communicated quite a few times, and we went on there a couple camping trips and wakeboarding, water skiing trips that we went on and just talked to him about his video game company. And he knew how interested I was. At the time, I was a sales executive. I was selling tech sales. So
right.
He knew I was interested in video games, and he got a call. I got a call out of the blue from him, and he had a couple different projects that he was getting sent over from Activision. One was a pretty big licensed project, and that was the Marvel Spider-Man game. And the other was what I was told was a smaller skateboard project. And so I went in, I interviewed, and I think one of the things that kind of got me the position there was I was tech savvy, so I could build computers, I could run computer networks, I could, you know, run mail servers and all that. Back before you just hopped on to Gmail, you had to run your own mail server. And so I could do all this stuff. So it was something I think that Nick West, the lead programmer, he could sort of, and also partner in Neversoft, he could offload that onto me. And so I got the position, and since they're, you know, they have two big games, the one was a big licensed game, and I got to be on the smaller skateboarding game, and that became the Tony Hawk video game series. So I was kind of dropped in the series with very little to no experience. I knew a ton from a user perspective, but I had no knowledge from a development perspective. So I was learning as I go and just trying to help the team as much as I could to make the game and hit our deadlines and make a fun game.
Well, what a game to start off on. I mean, that's you couldn't have asked for a better, a better hand in the career that you've, chosen. That's kind of the ultimate, leg up, isn't it? Obviously, right time, right place. And I guess you had no idea that game was going to go on to be this, extremely successful franchise, which not only changed gaming, but, pop culture and the sport of skateboarding and the world, didn't it, on so many levels?
Yeah. And I really didn't. I was happy to go on the skateboarding game because it was something that I kind of knew. I knew Tony Hawk. I knew Steve Caballero. I knew Christian. So I knew the names. I knew, watched videos. I was a fan of skateboarding. I did a little skating as a kid, but not much more than just an alternate form of transportation when I didn't want to bring my bike somewhere. So I was plenty happy to work on a skateboarding game. I was actually really stoked because one of my favorite video games as a kid in the arcade was 720. I played a ton of 720. So I was elated when I found out that I was going to be on. Plus the fact that it was sort of, it wasn't a big licensed project. The bar was set kind of low, so I could learn. And as I went along, although I learned pretty quick that, I was way above my shoulders in not knowing enough. So it was a real big learning experience the first couple of years for sure.
It was amazing to learn from the film just how hands-on and involved Tony Hawk was from the start as well, because when you see somebody's name attached to a project like that, you think, yeah, they're the face of it, they're going to do all the marketing and their personality is going to be across it. But the level in which he really, he took his gloves off and stuck his hands in and got dirty, didn't he? And he got involved with the playing of the game and the technical side. Like, I didn't realize the absolute depth that he went to when it came to, really lending his expertise to the overall feel and play of the entire game series.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, he definitely provided a ton of great feedback. You have to understand back then, 99, YouTube wasn't nearly as developed as it is now, where you could just type a skateboard trick and you'll get like 50 different variations of that skateboard trick. That didn't exist. So if we wanted to know what like a backside lip slide looked like, we saw things on video, and some of us had a little bit of knowledge of some tricks. But in order to be 100% on some of these things, we would cut little video clips, and I'd email him to Tony, and Tony would email him back, or even better yet, sometimes we would email him tricks that we wanted reference footage for our animators, and he would, go out with his filmer and he'd film them at multiple angles for us, and we'd get video footage from him, and then on top of it, sending him the builds every week and just getting feedback from him, and at the beginning, and Jamie Thomas was giving us quite a bit of feedback too. That was awesome. It was invaluable to kind of keep us in line with the skate culture. And we made mistakes along the way for sure, but we tried our best to keep as close to skate as possible and give kids a lesson in skateboard as well as have a fun video game experience.
Well, it was cool because I noticed he would don don the kind of the Lycra suit with the balls all over it that you see that actor Andy Serkis wear for Gollum in Lord of the Rings. And, I guess that was very early on in that kind of technology. And he's there in the full suit doing it. And he was attempting, some of his most difficult tricks. So you had those reference points. And he says in the film, like, he got beat up quite a lot because he's obviously not wearing pads or protection or stuff. Like, again, I mean, everything you see and hear and read about Tony Hawk really, you know, it all feeds into this same idea of the kind of guy that he is, which is just this really humble, hardworking, down to earth, passionate, like on the level guy. And he comes across like that in the documentary as well. Obviously, you've got almost more experience of working with him than anybody else. Is that exactly what, you know, he's like as a guy? Just hands on, all in, great to work with, loves what he does.
Yeah, absolutely. And very humble, you know, no big ego, none of that. But, you know, he also is very competitive and wants to put out the best of whatever it is that he's doing, whether it be a video game or a skate deck. You know, he's always looking for the top notch, top quality, just like he did in his career in skateboarding. He was always trying to get that number one spot. So he's, you know, he's perhaps one of the best bosses I've ever had. After Neversoft, I got to work for him for 4 years, and it was, you know, it was an absolute pleasure. So, but, you know, his drive is, and his motivation to keep on progressing, and even to this day with skateboarding, he's still learning. If you follow his Instagram or his Twitter, he's still learning new tricks to this day. And it's in his own personal life, he's still doing new things with business and with skateboarding, and it's skateboarding companies that are kind of breaking boundaries in skateboarding. So, yeah, he's an incredible person for sure.
You get into the history of, you know, gaming and skate gaming and extreme sports gaming, but you also cover a lot of ground when it comes to the history and the culture just around skateboarding, the lifestyle, the craft. And I love that you get into it in that level. Was that always the intention with developing this film, is you didn't just want to come in out of the gate and, you know, everybody's already got the backstory sussed and you go straight into the game? Was it important for you and the director to lay the seeds and tell, you know, I guess the average non-skate expert, as it were, that, you know, this is the history of that sport, this was kind of what had happened in the lead up to the release of the game, and here's where that sport was at when the game came out?
That definitely wasn't in the first draft of our script, quote unquote script, and it probably wasn't even in the second draft. And the director Ludwig Gurr and I, we sort of butted heads on this at the beginning, and I'm super super glad that we went with his way, you know, in the end. And it's best for, it's a good lesson for, I think, a lot of producers to listen to your directors when it comes to creative direction. So yeah, that had a lot to do with his idea. I had initially wanted more of the focus to be on, you know, just more video game, but it was really his weaving of the story that once I saw it, and once I, you know, started listening and understanding, I was like, okay, yeah, that's definitely the best way to do it. You have to give people, the average Joe, the average user that may not know anything about skateboarding or the video game, they can still kind of catch in and you know, and lock in and start getting a little history lesson from the beginning, and it kind of drags you through the rest of the story. So it's not just an intimate, you know, detailed video gameography that just the hardcore video game fans will enjoy. It's something, I think, we capture a bunch of elements for that group, but then we also we do some things and some of the history that you get brought through that, you know, just your average person that enjoys documentaries is going to enjoy watching the film, and that story is Ludwig.
Yeah, it walks a lot of different lines, and it does it well, and it does it in a way that, you know, makes sense and it's digestible. And I don't really know much about the history of gaming, and so to have, you know, be introduced to characters like Walter Day, for me, that was really fascinating. And to hear about him, he's kind of titled the father of competitive gaming, right? And he talks a lot about the game you mentioned a moment ago, 720, and how that was really the only game that had preceded Tony Hawk's in terms of, you know, skateboarding in the computer game world. And so you've got that, then you've got the skate history, you've obviously got the personal history. I mean, what was it like for you as somebody who had, you know, a little bit of a kind of background in all of it? You're obviously right out the gate, this is your first big job. What was it like for you developing that first game? What are the memories that come back to mind of, you know, the moods in the company and you know, I guess the more broad reaction on a popular cultural level when the game came out? Like, what memories for you really stand out all these years later from the first pro skater game and, you know, the world's response to it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we were pretty heads down working on the game without much exposure to much, you know, of the outside world for the majority of the time. So there wasn't there wasn't, while we were developing the game, there wasn't this thing in the team where, oh, this is going to be a big hit, or, oh, wow, we've got this big, you know, sensation that's going to, you know, shake up skateboard. There was none of that. It was really just, hey, let's, hopefully we can make a game that is fun enough for people that, you know, they'll buy enough of it that we can get either another, you know, another version of the game, or potentially that was sort of like the big feat, or at least, you know, Activision might give us some more work so that we can all stay on and keep working. There wasn't like this big, oh yeah, hey, let's plan. So we started getting the idea a little bit internally that, you know, that we had something fun on our hands when we would bring in our focus testers. You know, we just got, you probably couldn't do this today in today's environment here, but we got just kids, you know, we put up a poster at junior highs and elementary schools. Hey, do you want to test this skateboard video game? Call this phone number. And, you know, you rip the phone number off on the bottom. And we brought kids in, and we were just not getting very much in the way of negative reviews from these kids. We were getting a lot, just tons of, you know, over the top glaring, oh, this is so fun, we're having such a great time. So that kind of gave us a little bit of a hint. But then I think the real big indicator was when the demo disc, the Pizza Hut and the Jam Pack demo disc came out, and people were just clamoring for that disc, and that disc sold a bunch, you know, that year. It was like a higher seller than most video games. And that was sort of like when it was like, okay, I think we really have something here now. Just gotta package it up, finish it off, make a game out of it, and ship it. But we still really had no idea until some of the early sales numbers came out, and that's when we were pretty happy, and we were pretty secure that we would be making at least be making another video game.
Were you aware of the Vans Warped Tour and the success of the combination of punk rock and alternative culture and skate culture with the Vans' involvement in that? Were you aware of this broader thing going on in the 90s, especially towards that mid to tail end of the decade, when punk rock and skateboarding were really fusing together and beginning to become the mainstream and take over youth culture? Were you aware of all that going on? And did you sort of look at the game you were making and think, oh, this is going to slot right in there? Because obviously the music was such a huge part of that series as well. Like, what was your connection to that side of it, to punk rock? Were you coming from a place of fandom as an appreciator of the bands that were in the soundtrack? And who was the guy that really sort of curated those soundtracks throughout the games?
So, okay, a couple of answers. And I have been a fan of different punk bands for quite a long time. You know, Bad Religion, Goldfinger, Primus. I mean, a lot of these bands are bands that I've listened to before the video game. But I wasn't as tied into the skate culture to kind of tie in, oh, well, if we do this element and we put this element together and we add the punk rock element, that we're going to have this masterpiece on our hand. I don't think anybody was. I think it was just, hey, this is the theme of game that we have. This is the look and feel of it. It needs to have this, you know, underground sort of LA, Southern California punk rock feel. And so the music just kind of came along with it initially. And that's sort of the initial roots of skateboarding too. It sort of grew out of the punk, you know, surf or skate culture. So
of course,
that,
yeah,
that kind of goes hand in hand. So I mean, you have to represent it. And I think we represented it really well in the first game and continued. But as skateboarding increased in popularity, obviously there are different groups of people that started picking up and liking skateboarding, and they're liking different kinds of genres of music. So you got to branch out of just punk and rock. And we, you know, then we drifted into hip hop and rap, and then even electronic music. And I mean, it just an assortment of different kinds of music that kids then eventually listened to. How the music was curated was, I mean, it got to a point where there was a few of us, about five or six of us, that were on the music soundtrack team, quote unquote. And we would basically sit around and listen to CDs. Again, there was no Spotify. There was no, you couldn't just put a song into YouTube and find any song you wanted to. So people would give me CDs. I'd rip the CDs. We'd sit around and listen to MP3s and make a list of, you know, what we thought would fit the soundtrack. And there were a couple guys that were more into hip hop. There were a couple guys that, like myself and Chris Rausch, are more into the punk stuff. Joel, the president, was more into, you know, classic rock and rock stuff. You know, different guys are into different kinds of music, and they would bring those to the table, and we'd listen to them, and we would start making a spreadsheet of kind of what our wish list is. And it always started from what we didn't get to put in the previous game, so we had something that we started with. And then that spreadsheet, I would sit down with music supervisor at Activision, his name was Tim. I'd sit down with him on the phone, and we'd just go through all the songs, and he would reach out to all the different bands and the labels and find out what the costs were. And I'd weigh the costs against our budget. And that's how that became our soundtrack. You know, we tried to represent each genre of music somewhat, you know, probably still always a little heavy on ska and punk and that area, because that's the roots of skateboarding. But we tried to represent, the other genres as best we can. And, you know, the soundtrack was something that kept expanding and expanding. I think the last game I worked on, Project 8, it was about $500,000 budget for the soundtrack alone. So it was a pretty decent sized budget. And then on top of it, we sprinkled in a nice assortment of indie bands that were free. You know, we didn't have to pay for.
Yeah. You got your band in one of the games, didn't you?
Yeah.
Got to be done. Dead End Road, the song Sin City, right?
Yeah. I'm the bass player for that band. Yeah, Dead End Road. And it's kind of funny. It just shows you, like, to this day, we still get a number of plays on Spotify. I mean, it's like 20,000-30,000 plays on Spotify a month, just because we're wrapped up in the Tony Hawk playlist. You know, we're just a no-name, you know, indie Southern California band, and we get those kind of plays on Spotify alone, just because we get pulled into a lot of the Tony Hawk music playlist.
Well, it was such a cultural moment. Those first two games in particular, I was never a big gamer, so I didn't follow the series closely, but I played the first two games a lot because I was big into punk rock, big into ska, and, you know, big into skateboarding. I wasn't necessarily good at skating, but I was very entrenched in that culture. And that game was just such a mainstay. It's amazing to see, like, I've toured with Goldfinger a lot, and John Feldman's a good friend of mine, and he's told me in the past about literally like night and day. You could compare before that game came out and then afterwards, like, especially in the UK when they came over here, and he said that, you know, they'd play that song, the whole crowd would just completely lose it. And he was like, oh wow, like, nothing's ever going to be the same again. And it's just, and it, the memories that are attached to that game, and certain songs like the Millencolin track No Cigar as well, there's just a few songs from that that soundtrack series that you can't hear. And I'm sure, you know, you've heard this loads over the years, and it's obviously in the documentary as well with Feldy talking about it, but you can't really hear these songs without thinking about that game, even now, all these years later. And that's such a rare thing, isn't it? Such a special thing.
Yeah. And I think, what I kind of attribute it to is, you know, when you're video gaming, generally you're by yourself. And similarly, when you're listening to music, a lot of times you're by yourself. But the one thing with video gaming, you're doing something interactive, and you're having this full experience. And the music is part of that full experience. So then when you think of that song, and it wasn't an unlimited soundtrack, let's be honest. It had only so many songs. So if you play the game enough hours, you were hearing the soundtrack over and over and over again.
Well that was the beauty of the 90s, wasn't it, Ralph? The beauty of the 90s was there wasn't iPods, there wasn't Spotify. So you'd have your car with, say, four or five CDs, and they'd get played on repeat. And so those tracks would be embedded in your brain, wouldn't they?
Yeah. And so you have like this, there are certain music that I know that I went on a road trip, and that road trip, you know, the nostalgia of it starts flooding in my mind. I think that became even more powerful with these tracks, because you're having this experience of, you know, this pleasureful video gaming experience while you're enjoying this music that's amplifying it. So I think it kind of enhanced the whole situation in people's heads a bit.
Bad Religion have got a book coming out, haven't they? Are you a big Bad Religion fan? I know you got Jay Bentley.
Yeah, I've got it. It should be here today. It's kind of funny, the serendipity. Their date and our date lined up exactly the same. So their release date is today for their book.
Yeah.
I got it. It might be at my front door. I'm not sure.
I just looked on Spotify to see what their top most played song was, and You was second. 21st Century Digital Boy was first, which you'd think, yeah, that's a given. But You, yeah, the only reason You is number two is because, again, of Tony Hawk, isn't it? It's got to be.
Yeah, if you look at a lot of bands, unless there was some, you know, major YouTube thing that happened or some major MTV YouTube thing that happened, if you look at a lot of bands on Spotify, if their song was on in the video game, that's their number one song in their entire discography, or it's the number one song on that album was played because of how impactful that soundtrack playlist is. So I'm telling you, just our small little band makes, you know, 20, 30 bucks a month off of Spotify just on a dumb song we put in a video game back in, 2004, you know?
Incredible. And I love the way that Jay talks about how when it was just him and Brett at Epitaph back in the day, they'd, you know, get the letter from you guys, which is, we want to use your track to put in this game. Brett's like, I don't know what that is, but let's do it. Imagine if they'd said
that
no.
Was kind of some of the easiest. Yeah, I know. That was kind of, and, you know, there were bands that did say no. Punk was a bit easier. It was the easiest of all the music genres to clear, not only from just the ease of just getting the paperwork done, but from a monetary perspective as well, it was always the cheapest to get for different tracks. Whereas hip hop was always on the higher end. It kind of flowed suit with sort of the mentality of punk rock versus hip hop.
I have two questions for you. You don't have to answer them if you don't want. The first one was going to be who did turn down the offer? And then the second was going to be who was the most expensive song by, like who was the, you know, this is how much we want. And you're like, well, the song's pretty good. We're going to pay it.
Yeah. I mean, I can't tell you, I can tell you, we had plenty of hip hop artists that we didn't end up going with. I can't tell you who they are. It wasn't that genre. I mean, I like some of the old school stuff, like, you know, Run DMC and Snoop and Ice Cube and NWA, and I like some of that old stuff, but I can't tell you mid 90s or late 90s, early 2000s hip hop who some of the guys were. But there were people that turned you know, the money, it just didn't work out. It was just way too expensive, whatever. And who even knows if the band knew at that point? Sometimes when you're dealing with the label, you never know if it's even the band, you know, the band might have been more than happy to give you the track for free, but the label wants to stick it to you. So you never know who it is. I think one of the most expensive tracks, it was probably the AC/DC track, the AC/DC track back in, was it Back in Black?
Was it TNT? I want to say TNT.
Or TNT, TNT, not Back in Black. TNT, yeah. That track was probably one of the most expensive tracks that we ever purchased. I can't, off the top of my head, I can't tell you. I'd probably still have some of the old tracking spreadsheets. I could go back and look through or try to find and give you an answer back. But I know they were fairly expensive. And the Johnny Cash track was a bit on the high side, but,
How legendary to have Johnny Cash in there as well. Like, that's, you know, that's a left field choice. Obviously, he's synonymous with punk rock, not least because of the Social Distortion cover. But, you know, to put kind of old school artists like that in there as well, I imagine a lot of people would have discovered people like AC/DC and Johnny Cash through the game as well. Like, you're finding out about these iconic, timeless artists through a skateboard game. Again, what a beautiful position. Yeah. To be in, to be able to introduce kids to like these legends of eras gone by.
Yeah, I mean, talk about an eclectic soundtrack when you have everything from the Dead Kennedys to Johnny Cash and Frank Sinatra, you know?
Incredible.
It's a little bit of everything. Yeah.
Was there any games before Tony Hawk that used original music as part of the soundtrack, because I can't remember any before. I'm sure there were. And then the only game series for me which followed that did it on a similar level was the Grand Theft Auto games. Like, for me, they're the two franchises that really stand out, Tony Hawk and GTA, as just doing it in such a classy way that, again, gives these songs a whole new, you know, lease of life.
Yeah, there were a few. I think, you know, arcade game, I think there were Crazy Taxi had a soundtrack, I believe. There was Street Skater, which was another skate game that came out, I think, even a little bit before the Hawk franchise. They had a soundtrack, but not, I think they sprinkled some more popular tracks in with I think maybe even electronic music that they created as well. So yeah, there were a few that had come around. We were definitely not the first to do a soundtrack. I think we're the first where the soundtrack became sort of this integral part and something that people were waiting on for the next game. And you know, what's the soundtrack? When are they going to release the soundtrack? That became a big thing. Like, you know, what's the next soundtrack going to be? And when are they going to announce the next soundtrack? I don't think there were many other games that had quite that sort of push or pull through their fan base for soundtracks and all.
Well, that's obviously something which continues to this day as well, because they've obviously, you know, sort of rebooted the first two games and they've rebooted those soundtracks as well. And it's still a point of much, you know, enthusiastic discussion. I see all the music websites that I follow, Kerrang, NME, all these publications over here in the UK.
Yep.
They've been writing about it in the lead up to the release of these games. And it's still like a very coveted spot. And a lot of bands that I know who are in the new one, like, I know bands who are in the original, I know bands that are in the new, and they're still like, you feel pride and excitement to be attached to that franchise, which, again, you know, all these years later, that's such a testament to the legacy of those games that people still, like, that's a coveted spot that they're stoked to be in.
Yeah, it's always good to hear, you know, having worked on it, it's always good to hear that people are so stoked on, and it had such a big impact. And that's really one of the biggest reasons why, you know, we made the decision early on that if we're going to do a Tony Hawk video game documentary, we have to have, you know, a handful of the tracks that are just the epitome of Tony Hawk video games. And we did whatever we could to make that happen, to fill the film up with as many kind of iconic tracks that bring back that nostalgia. Because again, when you get hit with that and you see the video game footage, it brings you right back to that feeling you had as a kid in your room, or, you know, whatever it was, playing with your friends. And it's that's kind of how we wanted to capture it. And we think that the music that we added helped quite a bit too.
Well, you've got the beautiful acoustic rendition of the Lagwagon song over the closing credits as well. Was that something Joey Cape had already recorded, or did he do that specifically for the film? It's a lovely rendition.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, there was sort of a last minute change on that track, and we went with after we had gotten the word that Goldfinger did the Superman track, they redid the Superman track, and then Mike had redone the acoustic version of the Superman track. We swapped that track out with the Superman. Not that, I mean, that I love that Lagwagon. That's one of my most favorite. I just actually ran into him at a concert. It was a couple of years ago here in where was it? It was either Dana Point or Huntington Beach. And it was really cool seeing him. But that track is one of my favorites as well. But it was just an opportunity to kind of wrap the film around and use that acoustic version of Superman. I don't know if you've heard it, but it's pretty amazing as well.
I haven't. So the version of the film that I must have seen must be the kind of pre-final cut where the Lagwagon song is still in there. But I've toured with Goldfinger, and I've spent many, many nights watching Mike, you know, just jam on a guitar. And yeah, he's, you know, obviously MXPX, another great band. Did they have songs in the franchise as well? Am I right in thinking that?
Yeah, I believe so. If you had Ludwig, our director, on, he's like an encyclopedia of all this stuff. You tell him a song or a band, and he'll tell you the song and what it was in. So I'm not the best at that. I'd probably just Google, but I would think they have. If not, I believe they just were announced that they're going to be in the new one.
Yeah, maybe that's what I saw. Maybe that's what I saw, is they are going to be in the new one. Yeah, I was like, oh, there's the boys. What about the cast list, Ralph? When it came time to, you know, selecting the skaters for the first game, and then obviously, you know, particularly when you get to two, you've got, you know, the Cab and Rodney Mullen in the mix as well. Was that Tony's wish list, or was it a combination of people, you know, from the gaming side of it and the designing side of it working with him? Or was it literally just Tony Hawk was like, these are the guys that I want, these are the guys we're going after, these are the guys that are in?
It was a lot of Tony's picks, and then some internal picks. Like, I probably strongly trying to get Cab. I've been a big fan of Caballero for quite some time, but I also know so is Tony. So that, you know, having Tony throw his weight behind Cab is probably what happened as well. But yeah, I mean, a lot of the times we definitely would throw the ideas of who we were thinking to add to Tony, and he would vet them, and, you know, then that they would get at it. So as the game progressed, we got pretty liberal with adding secret skaters here and there, different kinds of secret skaters. It became fairly easy to, we had a technology where it was just a photo, you could kind of slap your face on somebody. So it became easier to do secret skaters, but the full, like, unlockable characters, those were still always treasured.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
There's a couple of really nice moments towards the end of the film when you're talking about really the representation in the games. Or more the guests are talking about the representation, I should say. And you've obviously got Alyssa Steamer and Kareen Campbell. And you see, you know, the kind of the new school generation of female skaters and black skaters saying how, you know, playing this game is really what showed them, oh, you know, I'm included in this culture too. And I'm inspired to pick up a deck and get out there and start skating as well. And that was, I wasn't really aware, you know, of the importance of representation in that series of games and how it's obviously gone on to inspire so many young skaters. That's another beautiful legacy to have attached to the project as well, isn't it?
Yeah. And that's, you know, that was a little bit amplified by Tony. He, you know, he was telling us how, and me personally, how so many people would, so many, you know, girl skaters would come up to him and tell him that, you know, they kind of were inspired by skating because of Alyssa being in the game, and same with African-American skaters, with Kareem. And so it was definitely a message we wanted to get out there, that it had that big of an impact in those two areas, and now you see, I mean, you see some of the girl skaters skating, and it's just, I mean, all the level of skateboarding, the bar is so high right now that all skateboarding is amazing, but it's, you know, girl skaters are doing just as all the crazy stuff that the guy skaters are doing. And I think the game had an impact on opening the eyes to girls, and as well as African-Americans and just any other community that it touched. You know, I know personally my next door neighbor, he was a little kid, never skated. I kind of gave him the games, and he picked up a skateboard and started skating, you know, and know it had an impact. So it's the impact is pretty wide. Skateboarding is going to be in the Olympics if next time we have an Olympics.
Well, Tony says that at the start of the film, doesn't he? You know, he's like, I wouldn't be here today. My career wouldn't be where it is today were it not for this game. And then the sport itself probably, well, definitely wouldn't be where it is today. And yeah, the fact that it's going to now be an Olympic sport is so amazing. And again, you mentioned like the crazy level of tricks and stuff that you see in skating now. I love the way that the documentary really sort of says, well, part of the joy of playing Tony Hawk's, I think, was that it wasn't entirely realistic. You know, there's an element of fantasy to it. There's kind of quite an insane scale under which you can sort of attempt things. And that's obviously bled down into real life. And you probably had young kids playing the game and doing these tricks, which wouldn't have then been possible perhaps in real life to do, inspired by, you know, the ambition and the scope and the insanity of some of the tricks in the game. Then they've applied that to real life and to skating, and you've seen like the ceiling be lift on the kinds of stuff that's being done again, perhaps as a result of the game. Again, just an amazing, inspiring side angle to the whole Tony Hawk saga. And is that something that you've witnessed over the years in, you know, skating as a sport? You've seen it progress in such a way that you think, wow, maybe perhaps it wouldn't have gone that way were it not for the level of tricks that you could pull off in the game.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, firsthand, my nephew is a skater, and he's a pretty hardcore skateboarder, and he, you know, he's thrown himself down rails and stairs and doing all kinds of different flip tricks and things that, you know, back when we were making, and he sends me videos of himself that when I compare it to some of the stuff I saw the pros doing back when we were making the video game, he would be pro. You know, it was just one of those, these are not tricks that, not just the average Joe kid skater on the street was doing, like flip trick in, grind, flip trick out back then. So, you know, and he's not a sponsored skater. He's just, he and his friends skate in front of the house. He's really good. And I don't think that kind of progression would have happened had it not been for a catalyst like what the video game did for kids all over the world, that they can do these unusual things on their fingers. And, you know, the first thing with in any kind of sport or any kind of achievement, if you see somebody else doing something, it then in your head becomes possible, and you can kind of wrap your head around it being possible. And I think that's the first step in achieving something, is you have to firmly believe that you can do it. And I think with some kids and some skaters, they were able to do that with the video game. They would look at how the motions in the video game, how the skater was doing specific tricks or combinations, and then in their head put it together that this is what my feet need to do to get there. And then once somebody does it and they post it nowadays, you know, they post it on Instagram, then everybody sees it and is like, okay, that's possible. I want to take it a step further, and whatever it is becomes, you know, gets even more and more difficult. So yeah, I think the progression advanced a lot further with and quicker with the video game as sort of the, you know, the sim, the tutorial, at least to give people. And even if kids, like my nephew, didn't really play the video game, he has the effect of the people that came before him that did, that were posting things on YouTube and are getting and progressing. He had the effect of being impacted by them.
We've spoken a lot about the impact of the game on society and the sport and culture. What about from like a design or a technical point of view, what are some of your proudest achievements when it came to that series, either a specific level or a specific style of play, or, you know, just when it came time to the actual construction of these games themselves, what was a real standout moment or two for you when you were like, man, we nailed it there?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sort of an old school, like, I like the newer or the older versions of the game. Like, my favorite version of the game is Tony Hawk 2. So I think, you know, and we had sort of tested with the manual towards the end of Tony Hawk 1, but we knew it was going to take way too much work to get it all functioning by the time we needed to ship the game. So luckily we were able to do 2, and then we nailed down the manual, and that control, I think, for me, is what opened up the game completely. You know, it allowed you to combine different, you know, rail tricks together and still go and do vert tricks as well. But it also sort of leveled the playing field. I'm not a huge, and I get hate for this, but I'm not a huge fan of people doing 21 million point combos or whatever, you know, just doing tons and tons of combos. I'm more of a fan of, you know, over the top skate tricks, but lining up the skate line and trying to do a specific line and that kind of thing. So it was just enough to expand the combo system, but not so much when you added the revert that you then could just go wherever you wanted, however you wanted, for as long as you wanted. So I for me, the manual, and then, you know, adding Rodney Mullen, who's perhaps one of my favorites, he is an amazing guy to work with, and that kind of talent and skill to be able to work with somebody like that, it was such a great time.
His parts in the Bones Brigade documentary make me cry. Like, he seems like such a deep, beautiful guy. What was it like, you know, working with him for the game, but interviewing him as well, and getting the chance to spend time with him and connect with him and communicate with him? What's he like as a guy, and what was it like for you, you know, getting to know him on that level?
He's super intellectual and super, bright and very outgoing with him, you know, with the people that he knows and into, but he's also very private, and he's got very weird skate hours. Like, you know, he's skating to the wee hours of the morning, 3-4 o'clock in the morning. He was one of the first people that I contacted when I was thinking about doing the documentary, and he pretty much immediately replied that he would be down to do anything like that for me. And so he was one of the, again, easy guys to work with. It was just a matter of when he had time and it jived with his schedule, and trying to be the least impactful as possible. And, you know, we headed over to his house and we did 2 different interview sessions with him. The first interview session, I don't think we used any footage from that in the final. We just had a much better setup in our second interview, and we captured everything we needed in that one. So, but he was an amazing interview, an amazing guy to work with through and through, and will always be one of my favorite people in the world, for sure.
He's a beautiful man. I love that story that he recalls as well, where he talks about being in like a rough neighborhood, and he thinks he's about to get jumped by these guys that look like they're straight out of a gang. And then they're like, hang on, you're the guy from Tony Hawk's, right? And then they switch, and their attitude towards him goes from like thug intimidator to, you know, excitable fan.
Yeah.
A beautiful story. Are there any more like that didn't make the cut because of time or where the story was going? Are there any anecdotes that you really would have liked to have included, but, you know, perhaps there just wasn't room?
Yeah, there are, and there'll be some. You'll see some. We're going to drop some more extra stuff on our social media, and we have some extras on iTunes. And I know when we eventually do a DVD or Blu-ray release, we'll have some extras put on there as well. But, you know, it's as much footage as we have, it's hard to when you come up with the final cut, it's kind of difficult to go, oh, you know, we should have had this or that. If you do that, you'll never finish the film.
Of course.
So you have to kind of draw the line at some point. And I think we did the best we got, you know, and I'm glad that a lot of people are enjoying it. And it's kind of great that it's finally out there.
Well, it's a first time film for yourself as producer and the director as well, right? So how was the experience of transitioning into feature-length filmmaking for the pair of you? Obviously, you can't speak entirely for him, but from your point of view, how was it donning the film producer hat and getting stuck into this project?
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, I've been a producer of many different things for quite a long time, from video games, and I drifted into apps and websites and smaller video games and things, but and a lot of video content. But this was the first time with this, and, you know, we made a lot of different mistakes. You learn from your mistakes and become a lot more knowledgeable. But, you know, everything that we went through, we just kind of dug in and always kept the ball moving forward. I think a lot of times people get run up against different challenges and stop and, you know, stall, but that's not what we did. And we just kind of, any of the new things that we came up against, Lidvig had a little bit of experience. He did a couple shorts before. He actually got an award for one of his shorts at the Swedish Film Festival. So he had a tad bit of experience, but not anything, you know, substantial. So it was a new world for us. We did along the way meet a lot of really good people that helped us out. The folks that we worked with at the Mammoth Film Festival, where we won a couple awards, they were awesome. Tanner and his crew up at Mammoth Film Festival, and then meeting up with Tara and Joe at Wood Entertainment, our distributors. That was another really huge thing that came out of Mammoth. Just been great people to work with, and really helped us in becoming, you know, from real indie newbies, complete newbies, to, you know, setting us in the right direction for sure.
Well, you won Best Documentary Award, didn't you? Which is amazing.
Yeah, that was awesome. We were stoked on that for sure.
And you should be incredibly proud. I mean, for the story alone, like, you know, it's always going to be a good documentary, but the way that you've, as I said earlier on, managed to, you know, walk the line of the various different subplots and tie it all together and always keep the emotion and the pace. And it's a really well executed film, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I've seen it twice, and, you know, I enjoyed it even more the second time.
Excellent.
And
I appreciate it.
It just brought back so much good feelings and nostalgia. I bet you must be gutted because of COVID. Obviously COVID has hindered many things, but this would have been like the ultimate premiere, wouldn't it? Of all the skaters, all the bands, like, what a beautiful release party you could have had. And I guess that's something that you haven't been able to do.
No, we actually had a theatrical, like, one night only that was going to be planned. And we were looking at having, you know, one of the, and I don't even want to go into so many of the details. It is gutting, but it's, you know, we're looking at having a band do some live music before the theater, and then doing a live QA after the showing and all that good stuff. But yeah, COVID kind of kicked us in the nuts. What are you going to do? I mean, many other people have been worse off. I've had some family been very impacted, but it's not, you know, direct family and friends. Not so much, you know, aside from just all the craziness that we've had to go through. But yeah, it's the reality of the world we live in. You know, we will do something once this kind of opens up, once our society kind of opens back up a bit. We're going to do something, whether it's just a premiere or a live showing at different theaters. We'll do something for sure. But for now, this is what we get.
Yeah, well, you know, obviously everybody's at home with a lot of free time, so they'll be on the streaming sites and hopefully viewing it, which will be obviously beneficial to you. And as you say, I mean, there's so much history there that something has to happen when it's allowed to happen. And I look forward to seeing the photos from the other side of the pond. And congratulations, mate, and amazing work, not just on the film, but on all the games and, you know, just the long-lasting legacy that we've discussed, obviously, over the last hour. There's so many beautiful strands to the rich, multi-layered Tony Hawk story. I wonder if you wouldn't mind, before I let you go, finishing on the whole 900 tale and how that sort of, you know, came about around the same time as the release of the first game. It obviously wasn't planned. It wasn't intentional. It was just this beautiful coincidence that really, you know, set the balls in motion. I wonder if you wouldn't mind leaving us on that story of the, you know, the mythology of the 900 and how that helped launch the whole thing.
Yeah. I mean, so the game had been in development probably a year and a half, at least, before Tony did the 900. And I remember it just from the standpoint of a fan watching it on TV at home, and seeing him doing it and then thinking to myself, well, thankfully we had already started development of the trick a little bit, because we kind of were thinking, we were thinking about putting it in, but we knew that it wasn't something, I mean, this is sort of the realisticness of skateboarding. It wasn't something that Tony really wanted in unless he was going to do it. And so that was not slated to be his trick at all. He had two other special tricks. So, but, you know, it's a spinning trick. So it's not the most difficult from an animation standpoint trick. You know, now there's not a lot of body movements and stuff. It's more we lock in a position and spin. So from that perspective, it wasn't that huge of a challenge from a development perspective. And we had already started working on it. But I do know he called Joel, and who's the president of Neversoft, and asked him if he could, the next day, to ask him if he could put it in. And Joel's like, we're already on it, which we were. And so it got in. And the huge thing with that was not just that night and the trick landing that night, and it, the huge thing was the overflow of press that he got over the next, I don't know, 6 to 8 months that completely coincided with our launch, you know, and everything in our launch. So he's going on all these talk shows and lining up perfectly with our, you know, the launch of our video game. So it was, you know, the stars really aligned perfectly, you know, it's, the demo had already come out. People were already kind of clamoring for it. Then he goes out and lands this 900, and it was surreal. And it kind of, when I saw, when I was watching it, I knew that it was going to happen. I mean, you saw the look on his face after the 11th try or whatever they did, and you kind of knew, okay, he's going to do this. You know, it's going to happen. This is going to be a huge moment in skateboarding. And it did, and it definitely, it helped the video game just all because every time Tony Hawk, there was Tony Hawk Pro Skater, Tony Hawk, Tony Hawk Pro Skater. So that name just, it launched into the stratosphere. His Q score was like through the roof.
Too perfect, isn't it? Too perfect. Ralph, thank you for all the memories.
Yeah, it was perfect.
And congratulations on a great body of work, my friend. And all the best with everything going forward. And everybody can check out the film as of today. Is it available on the UK streaming sites as of right now as well? Is it worldwide release today?
I believe so. I believe so. You know, the best thing to do is check our website or our social media. We update everything where things are all the time. So, that's kind of the best way to go about it.
Love it. Thanks for your time, mate. I hope you have a great day. What are you up to today personally to celebrate? Do you have any personal plans? Anything nice?
You know, I might do like a bar crawl and go from my living room to the dining room, you know, just put a bottle in each room, and then to the kitchen, I'll have like tequila, and then the office, I'll have a bottle of vodka. So I might do a bar crawl. We'll see.
Amazing. You just need a skater's face on each bottle in each room, so you're unlocking levels as you go.
Yeah, exactly.
Nice one, Ralph. I've really enjoyed chatting to you, mate.
All right, well,
thanks a lot.
Yeah, appreciate the time. Thanks for having me.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.